Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And this is Start Writing.
And this is part three on our series on exposition, backstory, info dumps, flashbacks, all of that. So just to recap really quickly what we're going into, the general advice on exposition, on flashbacks, on backstory is to just cut it. But if you look at some of the really great pieces of fiction out there, they don't cut it. They include it. And so what we're looking at here is methods of including these kinds of things and making it work instead of slowing the story down, interrupting it, and breaking the spell. And so that's what we're really looking at. We're trying to look at some good examples. So we have looked at the first couple chapters of The Expanse, Leviathan Wakes. We have looked at examples from John Updike's work and examples from Star Wars about how to include pieces of backstory and exposition and really make it part of the story so that it feels like you couldn't pull it out or the story would unravel. You know, we've mentioned this multiple times. We're going to mention it again in case this is the first one you picked up. The line, "Luke, I am your father," from Star Wars, one of the great surprises of cinema, is essentially backstory, right? That's all it is. Darth Vader is Luke's father. But framed a different way, it comes off as just exposition and backstory, and it can be very dull. But the way it is revealed in the story, it becomes an integral part of the plot. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that Vader has a strong motivation in sharing that information. He wants Luke to join him on the dark side. And he has made multiple appeals to get Luke to do so, and they haven't worked. And so he has tried this. So Vader has a goal, and he believes that it will impact Luke's decision process. And that's the moment when it becomes a part of the plot and not just a piece of backstory, when in fact that's all that it is. So those are the kinds of things we're looking at. How do we make backstory, exposition, part of the plot, resonate with the characters emotionally, become part of the characters, their decision processes, and their moral dilemmas? And so this is part three of that series.
And I think we left off, we'd started into flashbacks. Is that right?
We've started into flashbacks. So this is the second piece of advice on flashback. You want the first, you got to listen to the previous episode.
Okay.
So part of what makes flashbacks work really well is when you instill in the audience a question. They want to know something. The Stormlight Archives. In the first book, Kaladin hates the Light Eyes. He hates them so much that he makes a lot of very bad decisions in his life because of that hatred. And we don't understand why. And there are multiple flashbacks to Kaladin's youth growing up. And every time we go to one, you're just so eager to dive into that flashback because you're like, are we going to finally find out why he hates the Light Eyes? Are we going to finally find out why he doesn't want a shard blade? Are we going to finally find out all these key pieces of Kaladin? Because character traits, these values that he has, create so many problems in his life that we recognize there has to be something very significant to have made him this way. And we really want to know what it is. And Sanderson does a great job of really getting us to develop that question in our mind and to crave that answer so that every time you hit a flashback, you're not distracted. It doesn't feel like it's slowing the pace of the story. There's something you really want in there.
Man, so I encountered this in my Starchild project. Book two had, like, the opening chapter was basically how the bad guy became the bad guy. And that opening chapter was in chronological order. But I think nobody cared about it. And so I cut it from this new draft. And nice. I'm going to put it back in the book three as a flashback once they hopefully have the question in mind, man, how did this guy become who he is. So I'm hoping that I can apply this. I actually haven't tested any of this on readers yet.
Right. Well, it might be tricky because most of your beta readers have read the first book in that earlier form.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I've actually got some new people to send it to that I can test it fresh on. I hope they like it better. I know one thing, that it was not very impactful where it used to be.
So. Right. So how did you realize that? What was the piece of information? Here you had this piece of kind of backstory, and how did you come to the conclusion that it wasn't resonating with the readers the way you wanted?
I think it's just nobody talked about it. I think it wasn't standing out, and it actually has quite a bit of significance in the story, but I just think it was positioned too early so that they didn't yet know that it was a big deal. So I think I'm hoping that waiting and putting it in book three, then they're going to be like, oh my gosh, I have been wondering about this through the entire book too, because this question kept coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know yet. I haven't tested it, but I'm crossing my fingers that this is a much better position for that.
It's a much better position. I think that's a good point, though. Your statement, nobody talked about it. One of the pieces of advice I've read a couple different places about writing your book is you need to have one of those scenes, one of these scenes that people really talk about. And if you sit down and you write that scene and then none of your readers talk about it, then, you know, that's a clear indication there's a problem there, because you are understanding the place of that scene in the story differently than the readers are, because you expect them to talk about it and they never do.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's like, I would have almost rather that they had said bad things about it, but they just kind of ignored it. And I'm like, come on, guys, this is so big.
So what is it? Did I send you that meme for writers? You are without a doubt the worst writer I've ever heard of.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, and this is from the Pirates of the Caribbean. And so the commander of the fort there, he tells Johnny Depp's character, Jack Sparrow, "You're without a doubt the worst pirate I have ever heard of." And Jack Sparrow's response is, "But you have heard of me." And so the meme is just that writer, right? You are without a doubt the worst writer I've ever heard of. And of course, you know, if you're familiar with selling books, he said, "But you have heard of me. That's success on my end." You know? Yeah. And it just really resonated with me as a writer, this "but you have heard of me," because the biggest fight for writers is to be known. And then you fight for the good reputation. But first, you've just got to get your name out there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many people just said terrible things about 50 Shades of Grey? But because so many people were saying terrible things about it, a lot of people picked it up because they had now heard of it. They now knew about the book's existence.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
So. All right. So we want to instill in that question for characters. And sometimes if we instill the question but don't answer, this can also lead to problems. So in an early draft of the Skyfall conspiracy, my novel, the main character has a meeting with President Roosevelt. He contacted him. He arranges the meeting, and he shows up for the meeting. And a lot of my readers were like, "How is that even possible?" And so there was this big question put in their minds, and I never answered it. And because it went unanswered, it became an unbelievable point of the story. And what was happening was I was leaning on the history too much. If you're familiar with the historical characters, William Stevenson and President Roosevelt were friends. And so for me, I was just saying, well, that's just part of history. But I needed to recognize that while Roosevelt is a recognized historical character, a lot of people were not familiar with Stevenson and would not have known that these two had a personal relationship. And so there was a question created that I had not answered, and it was creating problems within the narrative. So you need to create this question, but you also need to make sure that any questions you're creating, you are answering, not only because the readers want that information and it's going to help them enjoy the story and not find these unbelievable points.
Wait, so just real fast, how did you solve that problem?
So the way I solved that is basically it just inserted some exposition. So there's a point where Stevenson is captured by the Nazis. And the Nazi wants to prove that he, you know, is educated, thorough, and he knows his target. And so he talks to Stevenson about all the things he knows about him as a way of kind of showing off, saying, like, "I know who you are. I've been hunting you for a long time." And in that, we get a piece of exposition that, you know, he's connected to these powerful people like Winston Churchill and Roosevelt. So I don't know. The solve is fairly new. I haven't gotten feedback on the solve yet, so we'll see what happens.
Mm, cool.
So that's the second piece on flashbacks or backstory. You can frame it either way. I want to do point out something that my beta reader said, made this statement, I don't believe. And when you get that kind of feedback from a reader, you need to recognize generally that means you're missing a piece of backstory. Because if you set up the backstory correctly, they're going to believe just about anything, right? So as much as I have complained about I'm not a serial killer, this is kind of something that he addressed, right, about the demons. Like the demon comes out of nowhere and people are like, what the heck? Where's this coming from? And so he goes back to the beginning and he inserts that statement. This was before we knew about demons. Mm-hmm. Just kind of introducing a tiny bit of exposition to prepare readers for that. I don't think it was enough because I was still just like floored when the demon showed up, you know, and a lot of people have that response to the book. So as much as he tried to solve, I don't think the solve was big enough. And, you know, that may be my problem. Maybe my solve's not big enough, or maybe it's too big and it becomes a bogged down piece of information. It's a tough balance to really figure out, but that's a phrase I wanted people to be aware of. I don't believe. And when you get that, be like, okay, before they reach this point of I don't believe, they need backstory, flashback, or exposition so that they do believe, because that is what sets up that belief. So, and this was something you had mentioned before, but a great way of having backstory and flashbacks is lessons learned in life. You know, we all have moments in our life where we learned something. And you can create these for your character. So a great example is my stepfather does not believe in emotional trauma, does not believe in it at all. He doesn't think it's a real thing. At the same time, he was not around for the childhood of his kids for probably, 10 years. He was just gone out of their lives. And so now he has one of his children will bring that up repeatedly whenever he wants something from my stepdad, and he caves every single time. He has this point of very significant emotional trauma in his life and simply refuses to acknowledge that that's something that even exists in the world.
Oh.
And so it's a really interesting, like, if you don't think about this as my life, but rather you think about this as a story, that's a really interesting component, right? To have someone governed so much by their own emotional trauma but refuse to acknowledge its existence in the world.
And the takeaway is just that you, like, when you're in scene, that when you're in a scene that is being affected by the past, that's a good jumping off point for a flashback to then explain the reason why it's playing.
Yeah, you can put in this little mini story. So we talked about this with Amos, right? What would be the mini story where he learned that you can't shoot a standard firearm in space, otherwise it will launch you.
Yeah, you know, I love that.
these little mini, mini stories from life. I knew a girl, and her hand had all kinds of like crazy scars and stuff on it.
Oh,
and it was like you could see deep down into her hand, like all kinds of tendons and stuff. And so I asked her like what happened, and she said, when I was 4, I put my hand on the burner for a long time.
Whoa.
And that's what it had done to her hand. Gosh. And that's just a mini story. You know, how many we're told repeatedly, and maybe some of us have got just the slightest burn from touching a burner. But this girl waited until her mom turned her back and just slapped her hand down on it.
Oh.
And, you know, it left this scar on her hand. Oh, you know, just a little mini story. But it's a more interesting mini story than I touched a burner once and got burned. You know, like it's this deep scar on her hand where you can see all the tendons and muscle, because it had burned off the fatty tissue of the palm, and all that was left is the muscle and the tendons. And so it looks almost like if you see an anatomy book without the skin on the hand, that's kind of what it looks like on her one hand there. It's crazy looking. But yeah, just a mini story.
Man, someone needs to put that mini story into a story. Well, and I don't know if this is worth mentioning again. So you don't have to flashback as the narrator. Sometimes just the characters themselves can mention this or tell it to each other or something like that.
Yeah, so it can be done as dialogue as well. So we work through that Amos example, you know, we did it mostly through dialogue as Amos was telling somebody else these stories. So Lisa Crone on Thrass Blacks. As a lot of you know, she's someone we talk about a lot. We've done a few episodes on her theory on a story. And so she basically presents pretty standard advice. Never use a flashback poorly. So the way she explains it, and I thought this was really interesting, is when you insert a flashback, it's like someone tapping your shoulder during a movie to whisper something to you. And you know that if you look away from the scene that's playing out in front of you, that the spell of what's really compelling and holding you there is going to be broken. Maybe a better example is more modern, is you're watching a show and somebody taps your shoulder to show you a YouTube clip. And that clip maybe contains the same actor as in the movie, but it's distracting. And you're invested in the current movie and you don't want to look away. You want to find out what happens next.
I imagine movie theater when you said that, but even if you were in your home theater and you paused it, you're still interrupting the emotions that have built up.
Yeah, yeah. But I would say consider it this way, though. So this would be a flashback well done. You're watching a movie and suddenly the main character does something that feels very out of character. And you like shout at your TV, "I don't believe he'd ever do that." And then your friend says, "Wait," it pauses the movie. "I want to show you a cut scene from the movie." He pulls up this YouTube clip. And suddenly, after watching the little clip, the actions and choices of the character make perfect sense. And you look at your friend and say, "How could they cut this? It's so important to know," right? And that is a flashback that's well done, right? When you look at it and say, "You couldn't have this without this. It doesn't work. We don't understand the character's motivation. We don't understand their decision process, right? We can't recognize that."
Man, this actually isn't about story. Well, yeah, kind of. This is how I feel about the Mission Impossible films, like the latest three. The action in them is so amazing, but you don't really know how amazing it is until you watch the outtakes and see that it's all real.
Oh.
Not just Hollywood. But like, I actually think the drama increases if you pause one of those movies and watch how they made the action scene. And then you go back and you're like, "Oh my gosh, Tom Cruise is out of his mind."
That's funny. Wow. That is interesting. There's a tangent I'm not going to chase right now.
Okay.
I think that's a really interesting point. Be like, "That was an amazing action scene." And then somebody says, "Wait, watch how they shoot it. This isn't Hollywood magic."
Yeah, you don't even know how great it is until you stop the movie.
So let's get into backstory. So this is about getting to know the characters and understand them better. And it can create a lot of connection between the audience and the characters and a lot of tension as we see them make choices. Like, a lot of a great dilemma is creating in the character a backstory where it makes them hard to choose the easy option. Right? Can you think of any great examples? I'm going to take a minute here to see if I can think of any great dilemmas driven by backstory.
Well, I mean, you already mentioned Kaladin, but that was one where he was roped in by his past.
Yeah. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Stormlight Archive and the Way of Kings, in this society, the higher tier of people have light colored eyes, and they're the privileged class, and below them are those with the dark color eyes. And part of this is genetic, but there's also a magical weapon that if they wield it, not only is it an incredibly powerful tool, but it will also change the color of their eyes. And so Kaladin hates the light eyes. He hates them. Their privilege. He feels like they abuse their power, that they just mistreat people. He hates them. And his backstory has a very compelling reason for why he hates the Light Eyes. So at one point in the story, he is offered a shard blade. He has won the victory over someone who owns it, and he now has the right to wield it. So not only will it give him this incredible tool of power, but will also move him into the higher class of society. And he refuses to take it. And the dilemma there is entirely driven by his backstory. And because by the time he has the opportunity to take the shard blade, this weapon that will move him up in society and give him a lot of influence and power, we know the backstory. So when he is offered the blade, we already feel the dilemma, right? Immediately, like, is he going to take it? Like, we know how he feels about this. We know what happened in his past. Like, what's he going to do? This is intense. And I'm pretty sure Sanderson cuts the chapter right there, that we get his answer in another chapter, because it's a great cliffhanger. Like, this, you know, it's not, he's not hanging over a cliff. He's not about to die. But we're here seeing him make this incredibly difficult decision. You know, one side is his principles and his values driven by backstory. And the other is this offering that can have this dramatic life-changing effect for him. You know, and so it's a beautiful dilemma driven by backstory, not two hard choices in the moment, right? The choices in the moment are simple. Why wouldn't you take it, right? So much so that he's not even offered a choice. He's told, we're going to be giving you this. And he says, I don't want it. Give it to this guy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a really powerful moment and great tension. Again, all driven by that backstory.
Man, and for me, even then, I was just like, how can you make this decision? Or like, how can you? Yeah, anyway, it was a tough choice.
So, yeah, I remember a friend of mine talking to him about him, and he had read it first. He says, I know why Kaladin hates the Light Eyes. I know. He says, you won't believe what he does, but he has to do it. And he was talking about giving up the shard blade because of the hatred of the Light Eyes. You know, he'd gotten that far in. And he's absolutely right. Like, you cannot believe the choice he makes to give that up because of its significance in his society and his life. But you also know that's the choice he has to make because of how he sees the world and how he's experienced it. At that moment, when he's making that choice, that piece of backstory is essential to the plot, right? You cannot pull it out. Otherwise, that moment makes no sense. If we don't know why he hates the Light Eyes, if we don't know how he's been abused by them and everything, then we cannot understand why he would refuse the weapon. So in my third novel, I decided to include more of my character's backstory, particularly the villain. And he became the standout character in the novel. I think I mentioned this in part one. And he's the reason people – and he's the character people talk about the most, because they felt they understood him. And that's one of the really powerful pieces of backstory, is the audience can just feel so connected to the characters. I think one of the really big novels that did this really well was The Girl on the Train.
I haven't read that or watched it.
I would recommend reading it. I never saw it, but reading it, you become really connected to the main character. And when you learn about some of the really crazy stuff you've done, you're okay with it. You understand her frame of mind in the moment. Be like, that sounds crazy, but I know why she did it. I know. Like, it makes sense to me. It sounds crazy if you don't know all the backstory. And it's done really well in that novel, just connecting us to the character and leading us to these moments when she does this really crazy stuff, but it makes perfect sense in that moment. Oh, here was another example from real life. So I attended a friend's wedding. It was probably the most intense event in my life that I've ever gone to. And the reason is all backstory. So I'm going to change their names for the sake of the story, but I'm going to call them David and Anna. And what made the wedding such an intense event was that there was nothing that actually happened at the wedding that day. So it's all just backstory. So David and Anna had been engaged to get married 2 years before. And the night before the wedding, David called it off and ended the relationship. It just devastated the girl. Like, Anna was just, she went into a deep depression. Her family hated David for it. But here's the thing. David and Anna still had the same network of friends. And 6 months later, they were hanging out in the same social groups again. And once again, they saw the things in each other that they loved. That there was the reason they decided they wanted to get married in the first place. And they started dating again. And her family was furious. They ranted about how terrible he was. They refused to speak to him. They got engaged again. And the family just couldn't believe it. You know, they're just telling her repeatedly, remember what happened last time, right? They kept trying to talk her out of it, but she wouldn't back away. And so when the wedding approached, the question lingering in everybody's mind is, would David back out again, right? So we're at the wedding, and the bride's family is refusing to talk to the groom, and everybody's wondering, what's he going to do, right? Now, the day went normal and everything, but because of all that backstory, the wedding's crazy intense, and half the people look angry, right? it's a crazy moment, but without understanding the backstory, you don't know what's going on. And so a lot of David's friends, you know, are kind of like, dude, this is the weirdest wedding I've been at. but yeah, so that's, you know, this just the way backstory can add tension to a moment.
Huh.
And really change the way you understand it.
Man, that's a crazy story. That illustrates that really well.
It does. Yeah, it does. So, and backstory can also be turned into powerful revelations. We talked about Star Wars, right? How that information introduced at the right moment. And this is exactly what Darth does with the statement, I am your father. It creates this kind of turning point. And Luke can no longer, because it changes Luke's motivations as well. Luke can no longer commit to killing Darth Vader. He can't even bring himself to fight him anymore when he learns that piece of information. Right? Yeah. And so it's this huge pivotal moment in the story. And it's just a revealing of the backstory. And of course, you know, in going into the third movie, it completely changes how Luke feels about Vader and how he's going to deal with him. He no longer is interested in killing him. He no longer wants to fight Vader. He wants to convert him.
Yeah. Man, so I can't remember if we've talked about this on an episode. I saw that movie as a kid, and I just assumed that Luke, when he like lets go and falls down the big pit, I always assumed that he knew he would survive somehow, and I didn't know how he knew, but then later as an adult realized that, oh, he was like essentially ending his own life honorably rather than, anyway, I just think that's an interesting dynamic. That
yeah, well, I think in the moment he feels hopeless. Right. In the moment, he no longer knows how to fight the dark side. It is coming for him, and he doesn't know how to fight it anymore because he's not okay with killing his own father.
Yeah.
And I think there's a really intense moment of despair here. And that's why he does do that. And he survives, but he doesn't think he will in the moment.
Yeah.
So it's very powerful. Okay. And then, another approach that's often used in establishing exposition and some backstory and things like that is we have the outlander or the ignorance. In the Shawshank Redemption, we have Andy Dufresne, who's brand new into prison. And Red gets to explain the way things work to him, and it's perfectly reasonable for him to explain it because Andy's brand new. He needs to know this just as the reader needs to know it. So it's a tool that you see a lot of time. In the television series Outlander, the girl is from the future and doesn't have a full understanding of how a lot of things work in the past. And so it's a tool you'll see a lot. Somebody's new to a school, they're new to this group of witches, or they're brand new made vampire. You see this a lot as a tool of explaining the world, is introducing a character brand new into it. So Harry Potter does this exactly. We learn all the exposition and backstory of the magical world because Harry Potter has to learn it because he was isolated from it. So we didn't know about all that growing up. And so it's a great way to introduce exposition through dialogue that fits the scene.
Yeah, and I think that you just hit an important key, and maybe this is beating a dead horse, but we've talked about, as you know, Bob, like this needs to be authentically explaining to a character who really needs to know.
Yeah.
And if you don't need to know, it's going to hurt your narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think you said this is kind of the as you know, Bob, except it's not as you don't know, Bob, and you need to. Yeah. Here's the stuff you need to know about this world. Right. So we learn about everything about, you know, wands and capes and houses and all of it, because Harry's asking these questions. He doesn't know.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we'll probably cut it here and go into a part four on this, just because there's a lot of information still to cover. But do you have anything else?
No. That was a great episode. Good stories. Good real life stories.
Yeah. Wow. So, all right. Well, that's the end of the episode. We're all stuck inside, so it's time to start writing.